I thought Donovan was on the verge of asking for my report when Myrna came into the room with assorted edibles on a serving tray. The tray itself was the size of a manhole cover, very plain, probably sterling silver, and distinctly tarnished along the edges. The hors d'oeuvres, in addition to what looked like cheese whiz on saltines, consisted of a bowl of peanuts and a bowl of unpitted green olives in brine. No one said a word until she departed, closing the door behind her. Jack leaned forward. "What the fuck is this?" Bennett laughed at the very moment he was swallowing a mouthful of martini. He made a snorting sound as he choked, and I saw gin dribble out his nose. He coughed into his handkerchief while Jack shot a smile in his direction. I bet as children they'd paused in the midst of dinner, opening their mouths to one another to exhibit masticated food. Christy flashed them a look of disapproval. "It's Enid's night off. Would you quit with the criticism? Myrna's a nurse. She was hired to look after Dad, not to wait on the two of you. We're lucky she stayed on, and you bloody well know it. Nobody else lifts a finger around here except me."
"Thanks for setting the record straight, Christy. You're a fucking peach," Jack said.
"Knock it off," Donovan said.
"Could we hold off on this until we hear from her?"
He grabbed a handful of peanuts, eating one at a time as his focus returned to me.
"You want to fill us in?"
I took a few minutes to detail the means by which I'd managed to locate Guy Malik. Without mentioning Darcy Pascoe or California Fidelity Insurance, I played out the steps that led to the information on his identification card. I'll admit, I stretched it out, making it sound more problematic than it had actually been.
"As nearly as I can tell, your brother's cleaned up his act. He's working as the custodian for the Jubilee Evangelical Church. I gather he doubles as a handyman for various people in Marcella. He says he's the only one in town doing home maintenance, so he earns decent money by his standards. His lifestyle is simple, but he's doing okay."
Donovan said,
"Is he married?"
I didn't ask if he was married, but he didn't seem to be. He never mentioned a wife. His housing's provided by the church in exchange for his services. The place is pretty funky, but he seems to manage all right.
I grant you these are superficial judgments, but I didn't really stop to investigate.
Bennett shaved an olive with his teeth and placed the pit on a paper napkin.
"Why, Marcella? That's a dirt bucket of a place."
"The pastor of this fundamentalist church picked him up hitchhiking out on 101 the day he left home. Essentially, he's been in Marcella ever since. The church he joined seems pretty strict. No dancing, card playing, things like that. He did say he had a beer now and then, but no drugs. That's been for the better part of 15 years.
"If you can believe him," Bennett said. "I don't know how much you could tell from the brief time you spent. You were there for what, an hour?"
"About that," I said. "I'm not exactly an amateur. I've dealt with addicts in the past, and believe me, he didn't look like one. I can spot a liar, too."
"No offense," he said. "I'm skeptical by nature when it comes to him. He always put on a good show."
He finished his martini, holding the glass by the stem. The last vestiges of the gin formed a distinct scallop along the rim. He reached for the pitcher and poured himself another drink.
"Who else did you talk to?"
Donovan asked, reasserting his presence. He was clearly running the show and wanted to make sure Bennett remained aware of it. For his part, Bennett seemed more interested in his martini than the conversation. I could see the lines of tension in his face smooth out. His questions were meant to demonstrate his control of himself. I shrugged.
"I made one stop in town and mentioned Guy in passing to the woman who runs the general store. There couldn't be more than 500 or 600 residents, and I figure everyone there knows everybody else's business. She didn't bat an eye, and had no comment about him one way or the other. The pastor and his wife seemed genuinely fond of him and spoke with some pride of the distance he's come. They could have been lying, putting on a show, but I doubt it. Most people aren't that good at improvising."
Jack picked up a cracker and lifted the dollop of cheese whiz off the surface like he was licking the filling from an Oreo.
"So what's the deal? Is he born again? Has he been baptized? Do you think he's accepted our Lord Jesus in his heart?"
His sarcasm was offensive. I turned to stare at him.
You have a problem with that?
Why would I have a problem? It's his life, Jack said.
Donovan shifted in his seat.
Anybody else have a question?
Jack popped the cracker in his mouth and wiped his fingers on a napkin while he munched.
I think it's great. I mean, maybe he won't want the money. If he's such a good Christian, maybe he'll opt for the spiritual over the materialistic.
Bennett snorted with annoyance.
His being a Christian has nothing to do with it. He's penniless, you heard her. He's got nothing, he's flat broke.
I don't know that he's broke. I never said that, I interjected. Now it was Bennett's turn to stare.
You seriously think he's going to turn down a great big whack of dough?
Donovan looked at me.
Good question, he said. What's your feeling on the subject?
He never asked about the money. At the time, I think he was more interested in the idea that you'd hired someone to find him. He seemed touched at first, and then embarrassed when he realized he'd misunderstood.
Misunderstood what? Christie said.
He thought I'd been asked to locate him because of family interest or concern. It became obvious pretty quickly that the point of the visit was to notify him of his father's death and advise him he was a possible beneficiary under the terms of Bader's will.
Maybe if he thinks we're all kissy-kissy, he'll give up the money and opt for love instead, Jack suggested.
Donovan ignored him.
Did he say anything about talking to an attorney?
Not really. I told him to get in touch with Tasha, but she's the attorney for the estate, and she's not going to advise him about that aspect of the situation. If he calls her, she'll refer him to a lawyer, unless he already has one.
Donovan said, In other words, what you're saying is we don't have any idea what he'll do.
Bennett spoke up.
Of course we do. There's no mystery. He wants the money. He's not a fool.
How do you know what Guy wants? Christie responded with a flash of irritation. Bennett went right on.
Kinsey should have asked for his signature on a quitclaim. Get him signed off. Make a settlement before he has a chance to think too much.
Donovan said,
I asked Tasha about that. I suggested we draw up a disclaimer, thinking Kinsey could take it with her. Tasha nixed that. She said a disclaimer would be meaningless because he could always maintain later he wasn't properly represented, or he was unduly influenced, overcome by the emotions of the moment, shit like that, which would make it useless. I thought her point was well taken. Tell the man his father's dead and then whip out a quitclaim? It's like waving a red flag in front of a bull.
Christie spoke up again, saying,
Kinsey had a good idea. She pointed out that since the two wills were drawn up just 3 years apart, that the witnesses for the second will might have been the same as the ones for the first. If we can track down the witnesses, it's always possible one of them was aware of the provisions.
Like a secretary or a paralegal? Donovan asked.
It's possible, or maybe the clerk typist acted as a witness. Somebody had to be involved in the preparation of that document, I said.
If there was one, Jack said.
Donovan's mouth pulled down as he considered the point.
Worth a try. To what end? Jack asked. I'm not saying we shouldn't make the effort, but it probably won't do any good. You can be a witness to a will without being aware of what's in it. Besides, what if the second will left everything to Guy? Then we'd really be screwed.
Bennett was impatient.
Oh, come on, Jack, whose side are you on? At least the witnesses could testify the second will was signed. I heard Dad say half a dozen times Guy wasn't getting a thing. We all heard him say that, so wouldn't that make a difference? Why should it? Dad had the will. He kept it in a file right upstairs. How do you know he didn't revoke it in the end? Suppose he tore it up before he died. He had notice enough. He knew his days were numbered.
He would have told us, Bennett said.
Not necessarily.
Jesus, Jack, I'm telling you, he said Guy would get nothing. We've been over this 100 times, and he was adamant.
It doesn't matter what he said. You know how he was when it came to Guy. He never stuck to his guns. We might have been forced to toe the mark, but not him.
Donovan cleared his throat and set his glass down with a sharp tap.
All right, knock it off, you two. This is getting us nowhere.
We've been through enough of this. Let's just see what Guy does. We might not have a problem.
We don't know at this point. Tasha said she'd contact him if he doesn't get in touch with her first. I might drop him a note myself, and we'll take it from there.
Bennett sat up straight.
Wait a minute. Who put you in charge? Why can't we discuss this? It concerns all of us.
You want to discuss this? Fine, go ahead, Donovan said. We all know your opinion. You think Guy's a slimeball. You're completely antagonistic, and with that attitude, you'll be pushing him right to the wall.
You don't know any more about him than I do, Bennett said.
I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about you. What makes you so sure he wants the money?
Because he hated us. That's why he left in the first place, isn't it? He'd do anything to get back at us, and what better way than this?
You don't know that, Donovan said. You don't know what went on back then. He may not harbor any ill will towards us at all. You go in there punching, and he's going to go on the offensive.
I never did anything to Guy. Why would he hate me?
Jack said blithely. He seemed amused at the fireworks between his two brothers, and I wondered if he didn't habitually goad them. Bennett snorted again, and he and Jack locked eyes. Something flashed between them, but I wasn't sure what.
Donovan intervened again with a warning look at both. Could we stick to the subject? Anybody have something new to contribute?
Donovan runs the family. He's the king, Bennett said.
He looked at me with the slightly liquid eyes of someone who's had too much to drink. I'd seen him suck down 2 martinis in less than 15 minutes, and who knew what he'd consumed before he entered the room?
The man thinks I'm a dick. He may pretend to be supportive, but he doesn't mean a word of it. He and my father never actually gave me enough money to succeed at anything. And then when I failed, when a business went under, they were quick to point out how I'd mismanaged it. Dad always undercut me, and the notion that Guy can come along now and insist on his share is just more of the same as far as I'm concerned. Who's looking out for our interests?
It ain't him,
he said, jerking a thumb at Donovan.
Wait a minute. Hold it. Where's that coming from?
I've never really stood up and asked for what's mine, Bennett said. I should have insisted a long time ago. But I bought into the program, the story you and Dad cooked up. Here, Bennett, you can have this pittance. Do the best you can with this pathetic sum of money. Make something of yourself, and there'll be more where that came from. You can't expect us to underwrite the whole venture. Blah, 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 that's all I ever heard.
Donovan squinted at him, shaking his head.
I don't believe this. Dad gave you hundreds of thousands of dollars and you pissed it all away. How many chances do you think you get? There isn't a bank in this town that would have given you the first dime.
Bullshit, that's bullshit. I've worked like a dog and you know it. Hell, Dad had a lot of business failures and so have you. Now suddenly I have to sit here and fucking justify every move I make, just to get a little seed money.
Donovan looked at him with disbelief.
Where's all the money your partners put in? You blew that, too. You're so busy playing big shot, you're not tending to business. Half of what you do is outright fraudulent, and you know it. Or if you don't, more's the pity, because you'll end up in jail.
Bennett pointed a finger, poking the air repeatedly as if it were an elevator button.
Hey, I'm the one taking risks. I'm the one with my ass on the line. You never put yourself out there on the firing line. You played it safe. You were Daddy's little boy, the little piggy who stayed home and did exactly what Daddy said. And now you want credit for being such an all-fired success. Well, fuck that. To hell with you.
Watch the F word, ladies present, Jack said in a sing-song tone.
Shut up, you little piss. No one's talking to you.
Christy cast a look in my direction and then raised a hand, saying, Hey, fellas. Couldn't we postpone this until later? Kinsey doesn't want to sit here and listen to this. We asked her to have a drink, not a ringside seat.
I took my cue from her and used the opportunity to get to my feet.
I think I should leave you alone to discuss this, but I really don't think you need to worry about Guy. He seems like a nice man. That's the bottom line from my perspective. I hope everything works out. a paragraph of awkward verbiage ensued. Apologies for the outburst, hasty explanations of the strain everyone was under in the wake of Vader's death. Personally, I thought they were a bunch of ill-mannered louts, and if my bill had been paid, I might have told them as much. As it was, they assured me no offense was intended, and I assured them in turn that none had been taken. I can fib with the best of them when there's money at stake. We shook hands all around. I was thanked for my time. I thanked them for the drink and took my leave of them. "I'll walk out with you," Christie said. There was a moment of quiet as we left the living room. I hadn't realized I was holding my breath until the door closed behind us and I could suck in some fresh air. "Let me grab a jacket," Christie said as we crossed the foyer. She made a detour to the closet, pulling on a dark wool car coat as we passed into the night air. The temperature had dropped, and a dampness seemed to rise up from the cobblestones. The exterior lights were now on, but the illumination was poor. I could see the dim shape of my car, parked on the far side of the courtyard, and we headed in that direction. The lighted front windows threw truncated panels of yellow on the driveway in front of us. In the living room, the three Malik brothers were more than likely engaged in fisticuffs by now.
"Thanks for getting me out of there."
"I'm sorry you had to see that. What a zoo," she said. She shoved her hands in her pockets. "That goes on all the time, and it drives me insane. It's like living in the middle of a giant preschool free-for-all. They're all three-year-olds. They're still slugging it out over the same toy truck. The tension in this house is unreal half the time."
"Bennett's drinking doesn't help."
"It's not just that. I came into the marriage thinking I was going to be part of a loving family. I never had any brothers, and I thought the idea was keen. They seemed close at first. I mean, they sure fooled me. I guess I should have figured out that three grown men still living together under Daddy's roof didn't exactly speak of mental health. But what did I know? My family's so screwed up, I wouldn't know a healthy one if it leapt up and bit me. I wanted kids. Looks like I've got 'em," she remarked in a wry aside. "I hate sitting around watching these boys bicker and connive. You ought to see them operate. They fight over absolutely everything. Anything that comes up, they all instantly take the most disparate positions possible. Then they all take sides and form these temporary coalitions. It'll be Donovan and Jack against Bennett one day. The next day, Bennett and Jack form a team against Donovan. The allegiances vary according to the subject matter, but there's never accord. There's never any sense of all for one and one for all. Everybody wants to be right, morally superior, and at the same time, everybody feels completely misunderstood."
"Makes me glad to be an orphan."
"I'm with you on that one." She paused with a smile. "Or maybe I'm just annoyed because none of them are ever on my side. I live with a perpetual stomach ache." "You don't have any kids?" "Not yet. I keep trying, but of course I can't seem to get pregnant in this atmosphere. I'm coming up on 40, so if something doesn't happen soon, it's going to be too late." "I thought women were having babies into their 50s these days." "Not me. Forget it. Life's hard enough as it is. I mean, what kid would volunteer to come into a house like this? It's disgusting." "Why do you stay?" "Who says I'll stay? I told Donovan last fall. I said, 'One more round, buddy, and I'm out of here.' So what happens next? Bader up and dies. I don't feel I can walk out when things are such a mess. Also, I suppose I still harbor the dim hope that things'll work out somehow." "I'm sure my finding Guy couldn't be a help," I said. "I don't know about that. At least now maybe the three of them will gang up against him. In the end, that might be the only issue they agree on." I glanced toward the lighted windows of the living room. "You call that agreement?" "Oh, they'll get around to it. There's nothing like the common enemy to unify the troops. The truth is, Guy's the one I feel sorry for. They'll take him to the cleaners if they have half a chance, and from what you say, he's the best of the lot." "Donovan seems okay," I said. "Ha, that's what I thought, too. He puts up a good front, but that's all that is. He's learned how to function in the business world, so he's got a little more polish. I'm sure nobody said so, but I know they were impressed with the job you did." "Well, I appreciate that. But at this point, these people don't need a PI. They need a referee, she laughed. Tasha didn't do you any favors when she got you involved in this. I'm sorry you had to see him at their worst. Then again, at least you can appreciate what I have to live with. Don't worry about it. It's finished business, I said. We said our goodnights, and I slid in behind the wheel, taking a few minutes to get my car warmed up. The residual tension had left me feeling icy cold, and I drove home with the VW heater level pulled to maximum effect. This consisted of a thin tongue of warm air licking at the bottoms of my shoes. The rest of me was freezing, a cotton turtleneck and wool blazer providing little in the way of insulation. As I turned onto my street, I gave brief consideration to having dinner up at Rosie's. I hadn't managed to eat so much as an unpitted olive at the Malick's during the cocktail hour. I'd pictured sumptuous canapés that I could chow down instead of dinner. But the uproar had made even the cheese whiz seem less than appetizing. At the back of my mind, I knew I was avoiding the idea of going home to an empty apartment. Better now than later. It was only going to get worse. I parked my car close to the corner and hoofed my way back to Henry's driveway. A dense fog had begun to blow in from the beach, and I was heartened by the fact that I'd left a light on in my living room. At least letting myself in wouldn't feel so much like breaking and entering. I passed through the squeaky gate with my house key at the ready, unlocked my door, and tossed my handbag on the kitchen counter. I heard the downstairs toilet flush, and a thrill of fear washed over me. Then the bathroom door opened, and Robert Dietz walked out, looking as startled as I was.
"I didn't hear you come in," he said. "I forgot to give back your key."
"What are you doing here? I thought you left."
"I got as far as Santa Maria and had to come back. I was halfway down the street and I missed you like crazy. I don't want us leaving each other on a bad note."
I felt a pain in my chest, something fragile and sharp that made me take a deep breath. "I don't see a way to resolve our basic differences."
"We can be friends without resolution. I mean, can't we?"
"How do I know?" I tried to shut down, but I couldn't quite manage it. I had an inexplicable urge to weep about something. Usually goodbyes do that, tender partings in movies accompanied by music guaranteed to rip your heart out. The silence between us was just as painful to me.
"Have you had dinner?"
"I hadn't decided about that yet. I just had drinks with the Malick's," I said faintly. The words sounded odd, and I wanted to pat myself on the chest as a way of consoling myself. I could have handled the situation if only he hadn't come back. The day had been hard, but I'd survived it.
"You want to talk?"
I shook my head, not trusting my voice.
"Then what? You decide. I'll do anything you want."
I looked away from him, thinking about the fearful risks of intimacy, the potential for loss, the tender pain implicit in any bond between two creatures, human or beast. What difference did it make? In me, the instinct for survival and the need for love had been at war for years. My caution was like a wall I'd built to keep me safe. But safety is an illusion, and the danger of feeling too much is no worse than the danger of being numb. I looked back at him and saw my pain mirrored in his eyes. He said,
"Come here."
He made a gesture with his hand, coaxing me to move closer. I crossed the room. Dietz leaned into me like a ladder left behind by a thief.
End of Disc 3. Disc 4.
Chapter 9. Dietz's knee was so swollen and painful he couldn't make it up the stairs, so we unfolded the sofa bed. I brought the duvet down from the loft. We turned off the lamp and crawled naked beneath the comforter's downy weight like polar bears in a cave. We made love in the puffy igloo of the quilt, while around us streetlights streamed through the porthole window like moonlight on snow. For a long time I simply drank in the musky scent of him, hair and skin, feeling my way blindly across all his textured surfaces. The heat from his body thawed my cold limbs. I felt like a snake curling up in a patch of sunlight, warmed to the depths after a long, unforgiving winter.
I remembered his ways from our 3 months together. The look on his face, the hapless sounds he made. What I'd forgotten was the smoldering response he awakened in me. There was a brief time in my youth when my behavior was both reckless and promiscuous. Those were the days when there seemed to be no consequences to sex that wasn't easily cured. In the current marketplace, you'd have to be a fool, or suicidal, to risk the casual encounter without a lot of straight talk and doctor certificates changing hands. For my purposes, celibacy is my habitual state. I suppose it's a lot like living in times of famine. Without hope of satiation, hunger diminishes and the appetite fades. With Dietz, I could feel all my physical senses quicken, the yearning for contact overcoming my natural reticence. Dietz's injury required patience and ingenuity, but somehow we managed. The process entailed considerable laughter at our contortions and quiet concentration during the moments between. Finally, at 10, I flung the covers aside, exposing our sweaty bodies to the Arctic temperatures surrounding us. "I don't know about you, but I'm starving," I said. "If we don't stop and eat soon, I'll be dead before morning." 30 minutes later, showered and dressed, we found ourselves sitting up at Rosie's in my favorite booth. She and William were both working, he behind the bar and Rosie out waiting tables. Ordinarily, the kitchen closed down at 10, and I could see she was just on the verge of saying as much when she noticed the whisker burn that had set my cheeks aflame. I put my chin in my palm, but not before she caught sight of my sex rash. The woman may be close to 70, but she's not unperceptive. She seemed to take in at a glance both the source of our satisfaction and our avid interest in food. I thought the application of my makeup had successfully disguised my chafed flesh, but she was visibly smirking as she recited the meal she intended to prepare for us. With Rosie, there's no point in even pretending to order. You eat what she decides will be perfect for the occasion. In honor of Dietz's return, I noticed her English was marginally improved. She parked herself sideways to the table, wiggling slightly in place, refusing to look directly at either of us after that first sly glance. "Now, here's what you're gonna get, and don't make with the usual face, like this, while I'm telling you." She pulled her mouth down, eyes rolling to show Dietz my usual enthusiasm for her choices. "I'm fixing korhelevish. It's also called Sauce's soup. Is taking couple pounds of sauerkraut, paprika, smoked sausage, and some sour cream. Is guaranteed to perk up tired senses, of which you look like you got a lot. Then I'm roasting you little chicken that I'm served with mushroom pudding. Is very good. And for after is hazelnut tort, but no coffee. You need sleep. I'm bringing wine in a minute. Don't go away."
We didn't leave until midnight. We didn't sleep until 1. Wound together on the narrow width of the sofa bed. I'm not accustomed to sleeping with someone else, and I can't say it netted me any restful results. Because of his knee, Dietz was forced to lie on his back with a pillow supporting his left leg. This gave me 2 choices. I could lie pressed against him with my head resting on his chest, or flat on my back with our bodies touching along their lengths. I tried one and then the other, tossing relentlessly as the hours ticked away. Half the time I could feel the sofa's metal mechanism cut across my back, but if I switched to the other position with my head on his chest, I suffered from heat stroke, a dead arm, and a canned left ear. Sometimes I could feel the exhalation of his breath on my cheek, and the effect drove me mad. I found myself counting as he breathed, in and out, in and out. In moments the rhythm changed, and there'd be a long pause in which I wondered if he were in the process of dropping dead. Dietz slept like a soldier under combat conditions. His snores were gentle snuffles, just loud enough to keep me on sentry duty, but not quite loud enough to draw enemy fire. I slept finally, amazingly, and woke at 7, energized. Dietz had made coffee and he was reading the paper, dressed, his hair damp, a pair of half glasses sitting low on his nose. I watched him for a few minutes until his gaze came up to mine. "I didn't know you wore glasses."
"I was too vain before this. The minute you were out the door, I put them on,"
he said with that crooked smile of his. I turned on my side, folding my right arm under my cheek. "What time will the boys be expecting you?"
Early afternoon. I have motel reservations at a place close by. If they want to spend the night, I'll have room.
I'll bet you look forward to seeing them.
Yes, but I'm nervous about it, too. I haven't seen them for 2 years, since I left for Germany. I'm never quite sure what to talk about with them.
What do you talk to anyone about?
Mostly bullshit. Even bullshit requires a context. It gets awkward for them, too. Sometimes we end up going to the movies just to have something to talk about later. I'm not exactly a fount of paternal advice. Once I quiz them about girlfriends and classes, I'm about out of conversation.
You'll do fine.
I hope. What about you? What's your day looking like?
I don't know. This is Saturday, so I don't have to work. I'll probably nap, starting soon.
You want company?
Dietz, I said, outraged. If you get in this bed again, I won't be able to walk.
You're an amateur.
I am. I'm not used to this stuff.
How about some coffee?
Let me brush my teeth first. After breakfast, we went down to the beach. The day was cloudy, the marine layer holding in the heat like foam insulation. The temperature was close to 70, and the air soft and fruity with a tropical scent. Santa Teresa winters are filled with such contradictions. One day will feel icy, while the next day feels mild. The ocean had a slick sheen, reflecting the uniform white of the sky. We took off our shoes and carried them, scuffling along the water's edge with the frothy play of waves rolling across our bare feet. Seagulls hovered overhead, screeching, while two dogs leaped in unison, snapping at the birds as if they were low-flying frisbees. Dietz took off at 9, holding me crushed against him before he got in the car. I leaned on the hood and we kissed for a while. Finally, he pulled back and studied my face.
If I come back in a couple of weeks, will you be here?
Where else would I go?
I'll see you then, he said.
Don't worry about me. Any old day will do, I remarked, waving as his car receded down the block. Dietz hated to be specific about dates because it made him feel trapped. Of course, the effect of his vagueness was to keep me feeling hooked. I shook my head to myself as I returned to my place. How did I end up with a man like him? I spent the rest of the morning getting my apartment tidied up. It didn't really take much work, but it was satisfying nonetheless. This time I wasn't really feeling depressed. I knew Dietz would be coming back, so my virtuous activity had more to do with reestablishing my boundaries than warding off the blues. Since he'd done the grocery shopping, my cupboard was full and my refrigerator stocked, a state that always contributes to my sense of security. As long as you have sufficient toilet paper, how far wrong can life go? At lunchtime, I spotted Henry sitting in the backyard at a little round picnic table he'd picked up in a garage sale the previous fall. He'd spread out some graph paper, his reference books, and a crossword key. As a pastime, Henry constructs and sells crossword puzzles for those wee yellow books sold near grocery store checkout lanes. I made a peanut butter and pickle sandwich and joined him in the sunshine. You want one? I asked, holding out my plate.
Thanks, but I just had lunch, he said. Where'd Dietz disappear to? I thought he intended to stick around.
I filled him in on the romance, and we chatted idly while I ate my sandwich. The texture of the peanut butter was a sublime contrast to the crunch of the bread-and-butter pickles. The diagonal cut exposed more filling than a vertical cut would, and I savored the ratio of saltiness to tart. This ranked right up there with sex without taking off any clothes. I made a sort of low moan, nearly swooning with pleasure, and Henry glanced up at me.
Give me a bite of that.
I let him have the plump center portion, keeping my fingers positioned so he couldn't take too much. He chewed for a moment, clearly relishing the intense blend of flavors.
Very weird, but not bad.
This is what he always says when he samples this culinary marvel. I tried another bite myself, pointing to the puzzle he was working on. How's this one coming? You've never really told me how you go about your business. Henry was a crossword fanatic, subscribing to the New York Times so he could do the daily puzzle, which he completed in ink. Sometimes, to amuse himself, he left every other letter blank or filled in the outer borders first in a spiral moving toward the center. The puzzles he wrote himself seemed very difficult to me, though he claimed they were easy. I'd watched him construct dozens without understanding the strategy.
I've actually upgraded my technique. My approach used to be haphazard. I'm better organized these days. This is a small one, only 15 by 15. This is the pattern I'm using, he said, indicating a template with the gridwork of black squares already laid in.
You don't devise the format as well?
Usually not. I've used this one several times, and it suits my purposes. They're all symmetrical, and if you'll notice, no area is closed off. The rules say the black squares can't exceed more than 1/6 of the total number. There are a few other rules tossed in. For example, you can't use any words of fewer than 3 letters, stuff like that. The good ones have a theme around which the answers are organized.
I picked up one of his reference books and turned it over in my hand. What's this?
That book lists words in alphabetical order from 3 through 15 letters. And that one's a crossword finisher that lists words in a complicated alphabetical order up through 7 letters.
I smiled at the enthusiasm that had crept into his voice. How'd you get into this? He waved dismissively.
Do enough of them and you can't help it. You have to have a go at it yourself, just to see what it's like. They even have crossword championships, which started in 1980. You ought to see those puppies go. The puzzles are projected on an overhead screen. A real whiz can answer 64 questions in under 8 minutes.
Are you ever tempted to enter? He shook his head, penciling in a clue.
I'm too slow and much too easily rattled. Besides, it's a serious business, like bridge tournaments.
His head came up.
That's your phone, he said.
It is? Your hearing must be better than mine. I hopped up from the table and made a beeline for my place, picking up the receiver just as my answering machine did. I reached for the off button as my voice completed its request for messages. Hello, hello, it's me. I'm really home, I sang.
Hey,
a man's voice said mildly.
This is Guy. Hope you don't mind my calling on a weekend.
Not at all. What's up?
Nothing much, he said. Donovan called me at the church. I guess last night the three of them, him and Bennett and Jack, had a meeting. He says they want me to come down for a few days so we can talk about the will.
I felt my whole body go quiet. Really? That's interesting. You going to do it?
I think so. I might, but I'm not really sure. I had a long talk with Peter and Winnie. Peter thinks it's time to open up a dialogue. He's got a prayer meeting in Santa Teresa tomorrow, so it works out pretty good. They can bring me down after church. But he thought it'd be smart to talk to you about it first.
I was silent for a moment. You want the truth?
Well, yeah, that's why I called.
I wouldn't do it if I were you. I was over there last night, and it all seems very tense. It's nothing you'd want to be exposed to.
How so?
Feelings are running high, and your showing up at this point is only going to make things worse.
That was my first reaction. But then I got to thinking, I mean, Donovan called me. I didn't call him, he said. Seems to me if the three of them are offering a truce, I should at least be willing to meet him halfway. It can't hurt.
I suppressed an urge to start shrieking at him. Shrieking, I've discovered, is really not a sound method for persuading other people to your point of view. I'd seen his brothers in action, and Guy was no match. I wouldn't trust those three under any circumstances. Given Guy's emotional state, I could see why he'd be tempted, but he'd be a fool to go into that house without counsel.
Maybe it's a truce and maybe not.
Bader's death has brought up all kinds of issues, I said. You go in unprepared, and you'll end up taking on a whole raft of shit. You'd be walking into a nightmare.
I understand.
I don't think so, I said. Not to criticize your brothers, but these are not nice fellows, at least where you're concerned. There's a lot of friction between them, and your appearance is only going to add fuel to the fire. I mean, honestly, you can't imagine the dynamic. I noticed the pitch and volume of my voice going up.
I have to try, he said.
Maybe so, but not that way.
Meaning what?
You're going to find yourself in exactly the same position you were in when you left. You'll be the fall guy, the scapegoat for all their hostility.
I could hear him shrug. He said, maybe we need to talk about that then. Get it out in the open and deal with it.
It's out in the open. Those three aren't shy about anything. The conflicts are all right out there in front of God and everyone, and believe me, you don't want their venom directed at you.
Donovan doesn't seem to bear me any ill will, and from what he says, Bennett and Jack don't either. The truth is, I've changed, and they need to see that. How else can I persuade him if it isn't face to face?
I could feel my eyes cross while I tried controlling my impatience. I knew I'd be smarter to keep my mouth shut, but I've never been good at keeping my opinions to myself. Look, Guy, I don't want to stand here and try to tell you your business, but this isn't about you. This is about their relationship to each other. It's about your father and whatever's been going on in the years since you left. You'll end up being the target for all the anger they've stored up. And why put yourself through that?
Because I want to be connected again. I screwed up. I admit that. And I want to make it up to them. Peter says there can't be any healing unless we sit down together.
That's all well and good, but there's a lot more at stake. What if the subject of the money comes up?
I don't care about the money.
Bullshit! That's bull! Do you have any idea how much money we're talking about?
Doesn't make any difference. The money doesn't matter to me. I don't need money. I'm happy as I am.
That's what you say now, but how do you know that won't change? Why create problems for yourself later on? Have you talked to Tasha? What's she say about this?
I never talked to her. I called the office in Lompoc, but she'd already left for San Francisco. And after that, the secretary said she was taking off for Utah on a 10-day ski trip.
So call her in Utah. They have phones up there.
I tried that. They wouldn't give me her number. They said if she called in, they'd give her my name and number, and she'd call if she could.
Then try someone else. Call another attorney. I don't want you talking to your brothers without legal advice.
It's not about legalities. It's about mending the breach.
Which is exactly what's going to make you a sitting duck. Your agenda has nothing to do with theirs. They don't give a shit about forgiveness, if you'll pardon my French.
I don't see it that way.
I know you don't. That's why we're having this argument, I shrieked. Suppose they try to pressure you into making a decision.
About what?
About anything. You don't even know what's in your best interest. If your sole aim is to make peace, you're only going to get screwed.
How can I get screwed if I don't want anything? They can keep the money if that's the only thing standing between us.
Well, if you don't want the money, why not give it to the church? The minute I said it, I wanted to bite my tongue. His motives were clean. Why introduce the complication?
He was silent for a moment. I hadn't thought about that. That's a good point.
Forget it. Just skip that. All I'm saying is, don't go in there alone. Get help so you don't do something you'll regret.
Why don't you go?
I groaned, and he laughed in response. Going with him was the last thing I wanted to do. He needed protection, but I didn't think it was appropriate for me to step in. What did I have to offer in the way of assistance?
Because it's not my place. I'm not objective. I don't know the law, and I don't have any idea what your legal position is.
You'd be foolish to come down here and have a conversation with them.
Just wait for 10 days until Tasha gets back. Don't do anything yet.
There's no reason you have to hop to the minute Donovan whistles. You should be doing this on your terms, not his.
I could hear his reluctance to accept what I was saying. Like most of us, he'd made up his mind before he asked. You know something? This is the truth, he said. I prayed about this. I asked God for guidance, and this was the answer I got.
Well, try him again. Maybe you misunderstood the message.
He laughed. I did that in a way. I opened my Bible and put my finger on the page. Know what the passage was?
I can't imagine, I said dryly.
Be it known unto you, therefore, men and brethren, that through this man is preached unto you the forgiveness of sins, and by him all that believe are justified from all things, from which ye could not be justified by the law of Moses.
Like many of the faithful, he could recite Bible verses like song lyrics. This time the silence was mine.
I can't argue that. I don't even know what it means.
Look, if you're determined to do this, you'll do it, I'm sure. I'm just urging you to take someone with you.
I just did. I asked you.
I'm not talking about me. What about Peter and Winnie? I'm sure they'd be willing to help if you asked, and they'd do a much better job. I don't know the first thing about counseling or mediation or anything else. Aside from that, all this family-related stuff gives me the willies.
I could hear Guy smile, and his tone was affectionate.
Strange you should say that, because somehow it feels like you're part of this. I don't know how, but it sure seems like that to me.
Don't you have some kind of issue around family yourself?
I held the phone away from me and squinted at the handset.
Who, me? Absolutely not. Why would you say that?
Guy laughed.
I don't know. It just came to me in a flash. Maybe I'm wrong, but it feels like you're connected.
My only connection is professional. I was hired to do a job. That's the only link I see.
I kept my tone casual to demonstrate my nonchalance, but I was forced to put a hand against the small of my back, where an inexplicable drop of sweat was trickling down into my underpants.
Why don't you have a talk with Peter again? I know you're eager to make amends, but I don't want you walking into the lion's den. We all know how the lions and the Christians came out.
He was silent for a moment and then seemed to change the subject.
Where's your apartment?
What makes you ask?
I was unwilling to be specific until I knew where he was headed.
How about this? Maybe we can do this another way. Donovan says everyone's gone tomorrow until 5 o'clock. Peter'll give me a lift into town, but his schedule's too tight to do much more than that. If he drops me off at your place, could you give me a ride the rest of the way? You don't have to stay. I understand you don't want to be involved, and that's fine with me.
I don't really see how that addresses the point.
It doesn't. I'm just asking for a ride. I can handle everything else if you can get me over there.
You're not going to listen to me, are you? I said.
I did listen. The problem is, I disagree.
I hesitated, but really couldn't see any reason to refuse. I was already feeling churlish because I'd put up such resistance.
That sounds all right. Sure. I can do that, I said.
What time would you get here?
3? Somewhere around then. I don't mean to be a bother. Peter's meeting is downtown at that church on the corner of State and Michelson. Is that anywhere close? Because I could walk over to your place and we could go from there.
Close enough, I said, feeling crabby and resigned.
Look, why don't you give me a call when you get in? I'll swing by the church and pick you up.
That'd be good. That's great. Are you sure this is okay?
No, but don't press your luck. I'm willing to do this much, but don't go asking for reassurance on top of it.
He laughed. I'm sorry. You're right. I'll see you then, he said.
He disconnected on his end.
As I hung up the phone, I was already having doubts. Amazing how quickly someone else's problems become yours. Trouble creates a vacuum into which the rest of us get sucked. I found myself pacing the living room, inwardly refuting his ridiculous claim about the relevance of his situation to mine. His conflict about family had nothing to do with me. I sat down at my desk and made some notes to myself. In case Tasha asked, I thought it might be wise to keep a record of the discussion we'd just had. I hoped he wasn't going to get a bug up his butt about giving all his money to the church. That was really going to cause a problem if he got greedy on behalf of Jubilee Evangelical. I omitted any reference to a charitable donation, thinking if I didn't write it down, the subject wouldn't exist. I picked up the phone again and put a call through to the Malicks. Myrna picked up and I asked to speak to Christy. I waited, listening as Myrna crossed the foyer and bellowed up the stairs to Christy. When Christy finally picked up the phone on her end, I filled her in briefly on my conversation with Guy.
"Will you keep me informed about what's going on?" I asked.
"I'll drop him off, but after that he's on his own. I think he needs protection, but I don't want to get into my rescue costume. He's a big boy, and this is really none of my business. I'd feel better if I knew there was someone in your camp keeping an eye on him."
"Oh, right, and leave the rescue to me," she said, her tone of voice wry.
I laughed. "Not to get trivial, but he is cute," I said.
"Really? Well, that's good. I'm a big fan of cute. In fact, that's how I vote for a presidential candidate," she said.
"Personally, I don't think you have anything to worry about. After you left last night, the three of them talked long and hard. Once they got done ripping each other apart, they settled down into some meaningful conversation."
"I'm glad to hear that.
I was actually a bit puzzled why Donovan had called him. What's their inclination? Do you mind if I ask?
I guess it depends on what he says to them. Ultimately, of course, this is probably something for the lawyers to discuss. I think they want to be honorable. On the other hand, $5 million might distort anyone's notion of what's fair.
Ain't that the truth?
Chapter 10. I pulled over to the curb in front of the Faith Evangelical Church the next afternoon at 3. Guy had called me at 2:45, and I'd left the apartment shortly thereafter, taking a few minutes to put gas in my car. The sun was out again, and the day felt like summer. I wore the usual jeans and a t-shirt, but I traded my Reeboks and sweat socks for a pair of open-work sandals in honor of the sudden heat. The grass on the church lawn had been recently cut, and the sidewalk was littered with fine green at the edge. The turf itself featured a pale, dun-colored haze where the cut blades had browned in the sun. A number of gullible daffodils had taken these balmy temperatures as an invitation to pop their green shafts into view. There was no sign of Peter, but Guy was standing on the corner with a backpack at his feet. He spotted my car and pretended to hitchhike, holding his thumb out with a smile on his face. I confess, when I saw him, I could feel my heart break. He'd had his hair cut, and his face was so freshly shaved he still sported a dot of toilet paper where he'd nicked himself. He wore a navy blue suit that didn't fit well. The pants were baggy in the butt and slightly too long, the backs of his trouser cuffs brushing the sidewalk. The jacket was wide across the chest, which made the shoulder pads look as exaggerated as a 1940 zoot suit. The garment had probably been donated to a church rummage sale, or maybe he'd bought it from someone weighing 40 pounds more. Whatever the explanation, he wore his finery with a self-conscious air, clearly unaccustomed to the dress shirt and tie. I wondered if my own vulnerability had been as apparent during my lunch with Tasha. I'd approached my personal grooming with the same insecurity, perhaps netting myself the same sorry results. Guy reached for his canvas backpack, clearly happy to see me. He seemed as innocent as a pup. There was a softness about him, something guileless and unformed, as if his association with Jubilee Evangelical had isolated him from worldly influences all these years. The reckless element in his nature was now tamed to a gentleness I'd rarely seen in a man. He slid into the front seat.
"Hey, Kinsey, how are you?" He held his backpack on his lap like a kid on his way to day camp. I smiled in his direction.
"You're all spiffed up." "I didn't want my brothers to think I'd forgotten how to dress. What do you think of the suit?"
"The color's good on you."
"Thanks," he said, smiling with pleasure. "Oh, by the way, Winnie says hi."
"Hi to her," I said.
"What's the deal on your return? When are you planning to go back to Marcella?"
Guy looked away from me out the car window on his side, the casualness of his tone belying its content.
"Depends on what happens at the house. Donovan invited me to stay for a couple of days, and I wouldn't mind that if everything works out all right." "I guess if it doesn't work, it won't make any difference. I got money in my pocket. When I'm ready to leave, someone can give me a ride to the bus."
I was on the verge of volunteering my services, and then thought better of it. I glanced over at him, making a covert study of his face in profile. In some lights, he looked every one of his 43 years. In other moments, his boyishness seemed a permanent part of his character. It was as if his development had been arrested at the age of 16, maybe 20 at the outside. He was scanning the streets, taking in the sights as if he were in a foreign country.
"I take it you don't get down here that often," I said.
He shook his head.
"I don't have much occasion. When you live in Marcella, Santa Teresa seems too big and too far away. We go to Santa Maria or San Luis if we need anything."
He looked over at me.
"Can we do a quick tour? I'd like to see what's going on."
"I can do that. Why not? We have time." I circled the block, coming back out onto State Street. I turned left, heading downtown, a short 3 blocks away. The business district wasn't much more than 20 blocks long and 3 or 4 blocks wide, terminating at Cabana Boulevard, which parallels the beach. For many years, the stores along Upper State attracted the bulk of the downtown shoppers. Lower State was considered the less desirable end of town. The street lined with thrift stores, third-rate eateries, a movie theater that smelled of urine, and half a dozen noisy bars and run-down transient hotels. Lately, the area had undergone a resurrection, and the classy businesses had begun to migrate southward along the thoroughfare. Now it was Upper State that featured deserted storefronts, while Lower State had captured all the tourist trade. In warm weather, pedestrians drifted up from the beach, a ragtag parade of sightseers in shorts, licking ice cream cones.
"It's grown," he remarked.
With a population of 85,000, Santa Teresa wasn't big, but the town had been flourishing. I tried to see it as he did, cataloging in my mind all the changes that had taken place in the last 20 years. Time-lapse photography would have shown tree trunks elongating, branches stretching out like rubber, some buildings erected while others vanished in a puff of smoke. Storefronts would flicker through 100 variations, awnings, signs, and window displays, the liquidation sales of one business flashing across the plate glass before the next enterprise took its place. New structures would appear like apparitions, filling in the empty spaces until no gaps remained. I could remember when the downtown sidewalks were made wider, State Street narrowing to accommodate the planting of trees imported from Bolivia. Spanish-style benches and telephone booths had been added. Decorative fountains had appeared, looking like they'd been there for years. A fire had taken out two commercial establishments, while an earthquake had rendered others unfit for use. Santa Teresa was one of the few towns that looked more elegant as time passed. The strict regulations of the Architectural Board of Review imposed an air of refinement that in other towns was wiped out by gaudy neon, oversized signage, and a hodgepodge of building styles and materials. As much as the local residents complained about the lengthy approval process, the result was a mix of simplicity and grace. At Cabana, I drove out along the wharf, wheels thumping along the length. I turned at the end until we were headed back toward town. I motored north on State, seeing the same sights again from the reverse perspective. At Olive Grove, I turned right, driving past the Santa Teresa Mission, and from there into the foothills where the Malik estate was tucked. I could sense Guy's interest quicken as the road angled upward. Much of the terrain in this area was undeveloped, the landscape littered with enormous sandstone boulders and prickly cactus with leaves as large as fleshy ping-pong paddles. The Malik estate sat close to the borders of the backcountry, an oasis of dark green in a region dense with pale chaparral. At irregular intervals, fires had swept across the foothills in spectacular conflagrations, the blaze advancing from peak to peak, sucking up houses and trees, consuming every shred of vegetation. In the wake of these burns, species of native plants known as fire followers appeared, dainty beauties emerging from the ashes of the charred and the dead. I could still see the occasional black, twisted branches of the manzanitas, though it had been 5 or 6 years since the last big fire. Once again, the iron gates at the entrance stood open, the long driveway disappearing around a shaded curve ahead. Somehow, the Malik's evergreens and palms looked alien, set against the backdrop of raw mountains. Entering the estate, I sensed how the years of careful cultivation and the introduction of exotic plants had altered the very air that permeated the grounds. "You nervous?" I asked.
"Scared to death."
"You can still back out."
"It's too late for that. Feels like a wedding where the invitations have gone out. You know, it's still possible to cancel, but it's easier to go through with it than make a fuss for everyone else."
"Don't turn all noble on me."
"It's not about noble. I guess I'm curious."
I pulled into the courtyard and eased the VW around to the left. The garages at the end of the drive were all closed. The house itself looked deserted. All the windows were dark, and most of the draperies were drawn. The visage was scarcely welcoming. The silence was broken only by the idling of my engine.
"Well, this is it, I guess. Call if you need me. I wish you luck."
Guy glanced at me uneasily.
"You have to leave already?"
"I really should," I said. Though the truth was, I had nothing else to do that afternoon.
"Don't you want to see the place? Why don't you stay a few minutes and let me show you around?"
I was just here for drinks. It hasn't changed since Friday night.
I don't want to go inside. I have to work up my nerve. Why don't I show you the place? We could walk around outside. It's really beautiful, he said.
He reached out impulsively and touched my bare arm.
Please?
His fingers were cold, and his apprehension was contagious. I didn't have the heart to leave him.
All right, I said reluctantly, but I can't stay long. Great, that's great. I really appreciate this.
I turned off the engine. Guy left his backpack on the front seat, and the two of us got out. We slammed the car doors in two quick overlapping reports, like guns going off. At the last moment, I opened my door again and tossed my handbag in the back before I locked the car. As we crossed the courtyard, Myrna opened the front door and came out on the porch. She was wearing a semblance of uniform, a shapeless white polyester skirt with a matching overblouse, some vague cross between nursiness and household help. I said, "Hi, Myrna, how are you? I didn't think anyone was here. This is Guy." "I'm sorry, I don't remember anyone ever mentioning your last name."
"Sweet, sir," she said.
Guy extended his hand, which flustered her to some extent. She allowed him one of those handshakes without cartilage or bone. His good looks probably had the same effect on her that they had on me.
"Nice to meet you," he said. "Nice to meet you, too," she replied by rote. "The family's back around 5. You're to have the run of the house. I imagine you remember where your room is if you want to take your things on up." "Thanks. I'll do that in a bit. I thought I'd show her the grounds, if that's okay with you." "Suit yourself," she said. "The front door will be open if you want to come in that way. Dinner's at 7.
She turned to me.
"Will you be staying on as well?"
"I appreciate the invitation, but I don't think I should. The family needs time to get reacquainted. Maybe another time," I said. "I do have a question. Guy was asking about his father, and it just occurred to me that you might know as much as anyone else. Weren't you his nurse?"
"One of them," she said. "I was his primary caregiver the last 8 months. I stayed on as housekeeper at your brother's request," she said, looking at Guy.
Her delivery was staunch, as if we'd challenged her right to remain on the premises. From what I'd seen of her, she tended to be humorless, but with Guy she'd now added a grace note of resentment, reflecting the family's general attitude. Guy's smile was sweet.
"I'd like to talk to you about my dad sometime."
"Yes, sir. He was a good man, and I was fond of him."
There was an awkward moment, none of us knowing how to terminate the conversation. Myrna was the one who finally managed, saying,
"Well now, I'll let you get on about your business. I'll be in the kitchen if you should need anything. The cook's name is Enid if you can't find me."
"I remember Enid," he said.
"Thanks."
As soon as the door closed behind her, Guy touched my elbow and steered me off to the right. We crossed the courtyard together, heat drifting up from the sun-baked cobblestones.
"Thanks for staying," he said.
"You're full of thanks," I remarked.
"I am. I feel blessed. I never expected to see the house again. Come on, we'll go this way."
We cut around the south side of the house, moving from hot, patchy sunlight into shade. To me, it felt like another sudden shift in seasons. In the space of 50 feet, we'd left summer behind. In the gloom of heavy shadow, the drop in air temperature was distinct and unwelcome, as if the months were rolling backward into winter again. Vestiges of the hot, dry winds blew down the mountainside behind us, tossing restlessly across the treetops above our heads. We rambled beneath a canopy of shaggy-smelling juniper and pine. A carpet of fallen needles dampened our footsteps to a silence. Near the house, I could see evidence of the gardeners, raked paths, the trimmed shapes of bushes, a profusion of ferns ringed with small, perfect stones. But the larger portion of the property was close to wilderness. Many of the plants had been allowed to grow unchecked. A violet-colored lantana tumbled along the terrace wall. A salmon-pink bougainvillea climbed across a tangled stretch of brush. To our right, a solid wash of nasturtiums blanketed the banks of an empty creek bed. In the areas of bright sun, where the dry breezes riffled across the blossoms,
several scents arose and mingled in an earthy cologne. Guy seemed to scrutinize every square foot we traversed.
Everything looks so much bigger. I remember when some of these trees were just planted. Saplings were this tall, and now look at them.
Your memories sound happy. That surprises me somehow.
This was a great spot to grow up. Mom and Dad bought the place when I was 3 years old. Donovan was five, and the two of us thought we'd died and gone to heaven. It was like one great